It's the Games Gone podcast with me, Tom Ross, and my guest this week, I'm thrilled to say, is the former Birmingham City and a number of clubs, but also Welsh international, David Cottrell. David, how are we doing?
I'm really good, Tom. How are you?
I'm absolutely average, if I'm honest, which isn't bad. I suppose, firstly, what's David Cottrell doing now? Because you appeared to me to quit just a bit too soon.
So what I'm doing right now is that I do a lot of mental health and addiction public speaking. I've got my own foundation, which is helping, you know, mental health and addiction as well. And also, you know, we look to help the homeless, and we're looking to help schools in the Cardiff area at the moment to try and educate younger people, but also educate the families as well. So try and, you know, just look after them and point them in the right directions. I think sometimes, you know, younger generations always think that the parents are always right, but we're trying to educate along those lines as well. I've also got the Crystal Matrix business, which we help with mental health online courses. So, of course, wow. During COVID, people can't get to people, you know, with, you know, the therapists, psychotherapists and so on to have that support. So we've created an online platform to try and help as many people as possible.
Well, you and I worked at Solihull Moors on a night like this, after Nick Moles tragically took his own life. More about that side of it shortly. Let's talk about the football side first, if we can. Were you always going to be a footballer?
Yeah, I don't think there was any doubt. I think from the age of six, from the last I could even remember kicking a ball, I always knew that I was going to practice and just follow my dreams. And there was nothing that's going to stop me, really.
I suppose, really, I mean, you played, I can't even remember, 20-odd times for Wales. You were a top player. You had a lot of clubs. Did you ever work that out? Why did you have a number of clubs? Because I think your longest spell was at Birmingham, and the fans adored you at Birmingham.
Yeah, I think looking back, I think Birmingham was my favourite club that I played for. Just because... I was thinking about this the other day, you know, on a Tuesday evening when we were flying high and we were playing home and the fans were singing, nothing is like playing in the evening games. And I just had that probably connection with the fans, but most importantly, my teammates were great. The management staff that I was working for, obviously under Gary Rowett, was everything just seemed to be going really, really well. I was back in the Welsh squad doing well. And it's a shame I didn't really get to work with Gary and be at Birmingham a lot. You know, a lot longer before that, because I think with the clubs that I played for, I was always under the impression from the Welsh managers that I played under that if you weren't playing regular team football, then you needed to find somewhere to play. And that was always my impression when I was kind of playing for a team and I wasn't playing week in, week out. My focus is always playing for the national team. So yeah. I think that's maybe where I kind of maybe bounced around the places a little bit more than usual, just purely because I always wanted to play for Wales.
I mean, you had it all, didn't you? I mean, professional footballer, playing for big clubs, playing for Wales. I mean, to many of us, you had the lot, didn't you? You had it all.
Well, I didn't have the hair, did I?
Tell me about it. It's amazing how many players that used to take the mick out of me at Birmingham because I was losing my hair years and years ago, but now they're bald as badgers and I'm having the last laugh. But I suppose really... I know that you've had your mental issues, depression and that from a young age. So how difficult was it trying to make the break into football with that?
I think that was always my escape, really. I always, you know, I was always practicing. I was always keeping busy playing football and, you know, it would come and go and the pressures of being involved in that environment, playing for a contract, you know, and you'd... I always speak about this when you're having your mates from such an early age of 10 years of age. When I was at Bristol City, you have to think you're having your mates that you're playing football with there. They're getting told they're not good enough. They're getting released and they're going home with, you know, crying their eyes out with all this rejection. And you look, and when you're involved in that bubble, you don't really seem to be that way just because you're purely selfish on what you're trying to achieve as an individual. So I was so focused on my own journey, but looking back, you kind of think, wow, the pressures that we were all under are huge because, you know, even as adults, you probably, you know, there's a lot of people can't really deal with those pressures, but yet we expect our, you know, the younger kids coming through that, you know, that coming through that scheme really with the professional game, and the pressures are huge.
With all that, with that extra if I suppose it is, it's a burden. With that burden of depression, and was it harder to deal with things like being left out the team or missing a chance, for example? Did you take it all personally?
I think with the chances that I'd miss, or if we would lose, if I missed a chance, I would always go home if we won and think, I should have scored today, but we won. That's all that matters. But if it was, you know, we were 0-0 or we lost and your chance would kind of could have got a point or win out of it, then you kind of take it a little bit more to heart. But I think probably the best athletes and the best sports people in the world, they don't really dwell on it. I was listening to Pep Guardiola the other day, and you listened to him talking about Phil Foden. You know, he can miss many chances, but he's still there to keep on going, and he's there. And I think that's probably what separates the top players from, you know, the lesser players, in that, you know, not being like the superstars of the game, if you like.
Is that what we talk about when we talk about players who've got mental strength? They can deal with all sorts of adversity and just bounce back. But some of us can't, can we?
Yeah, I think it's they have stronger resilience. I think if you look at Ronaldo, the Ronaldos, the Messis of the world, the pressures that they go through on a daily basis. Of course, they have the talent, but you know, their mental resilience, that even that separates, and that's why they're elite, and that's what separates them from probably the rest of us.
I suppose as well. I mean, and I'm being truthful with you now. Years gone by, I've done it myself. When I've gone depressed, what are you depressed about? You've got all that money, you've got gorgeous wife, you've got this, you've got football, you've got crowds of doors. What have you got to be depressed about? But of course, mental illness is no respecter of fame or fortune, is it?
No, of course not. I think that's what irritates me more than anything else, is that especially for some reason it's footballers' faults that, you know, even when you think about when COVID first hit, a lot of things you'd see on social media was, well, why are the footballers not helping out? And I just think, well, why are the footballers getting targeted before even, you know, the government or all these business people who are a lot richer than footballers? But everyone assumes that footballers are a lot richer than everyone else. And of course, we have great careers, and of course, we earn very good money. And, you know, of course, the big superstars are earning fortunes. But as you say, just because you're earning a lot of money doesn't mean that you're, you know, you're mentally not going through certain things in your life. Because if you look at Robin Williams, as I always refer to, is that he was one of the funniest guys who's ever graced the earth.
Yeah.
And he had all the money. He had a lot more money than a lot of footballers, and he was in a really, you know, a bad place. And that just goes to show, you might look happy on the outside, but inside you go through a lot of issues that you're not really happy with yourself.
And you're in a sport, football, a macho sport. You don't show your weaknesses. If you get hurt, don't show you're hurt, get back up. And so you're in that sort of environment. Does that must make it awfully difficult for when you're not involved in the dressing room, when you go home, where it all has to come out, I suppose.
Yeah, I think the thing is with me as well is that it never really came out. I was, you know, even my parents would, it got to my parents like, wow, is that what you're going through, kind of thing. And even with my alcohol addiction, even alcoholism, the illness, not many people understand the full illness of it. They always assume that when you're an alcoholic, you must be drinking from the time you wake up to the time you go to bed. But alcoholism, the illness, is how you act when you're drinking. You know, if you're acting like a complete and utter idiot and you're trying to, you know, do stupid things when you're drinking, that is an illness where, you know, it doesn't agree with you and you act like a certain clown, if that makes sense. And that's what I was always like. You know, I reached a point where I wasn't happy with who I was, what I was like. And when I was drinking, I was trying to take the pain away and of how I was probably living on my day-to-day life. I was drinking to take those issues away for a little bit, self-medicating, and the next day it just hit even worse. And it was getting to a point where, I know it's obviously a bit graphic, but I went out one time and I went on an all day and I had training the next day. And literally a few hours before, I had a knife to my stomach trying to take my own life. I had a blackout. I've gone into training at Birmingham training ground and everyone's like, morning, Cots. I'm like, yeah, how are you? I'm good. You like, but a few hours earlier, no one would have even seen, you know, I was in a completely different space.
I get exactly where you're coming from. I have a very good friend who's an actor, famous actor. And on the face of it, he's got everything. But he tried to take his own life.
Yeah.
You know, so I know, I'm trying to understand it from not being in that position. And it's ever so difficult when you haven't been there, isn't it, for us to understand?
Yeah, of course. I think a lot of people, you know, not everyone goes through depression. They say one in four, you know, will have a mental health issue. But I think everyone at some stage goes through a form of, you know, anxiety. It's because if you're going for a job interview, you get anxious. If you, yeah, you get nervous in a certain way. And for other people, it's a lot worse than others. You know, some people get so bad anxiety, which I've had before, that I didn't even want to leave my bed. I didn't want to leave, you know, my house. So that was a real issue for me, especially, you know, even when I retired and to the back end of my career, I never used to miss a training session ever, but towards the back end of my career, when my anxiety and depression was kicking in a lot more, you know, I missed a couple of training sessions, and I would say, look, I've got a headache, I've got this and that, but I was depressed in bed. I just lied to the, you know, the club.
So, I mean, I think you've mentioned Birmingham being important here, and you played more games for Birmingham than anybody else. Your contract was cancelled by mutual consent, and yet you were a really good player for us. So was that due to your mental well-being or the dependency on alcohol, for example? Was that the reason behind that, do you think?
No, I don't think they were probably aware of me going out, and they probably just wanted to get me out the door to be someone else's problem. I think that's what I have the issue with most clubs in this country, is that if you have players suffering with mental health or an addiction, you should be thinking, how can I support that individual as a human being? Not as, right, he can be someone else's fault, let's get him out the door. The reason why I left Birmingham is because I was negotiating a new contract with Gary Rowett before he left. And it was a surprise to all of us that he left. He came to the meeting room and we had that whispers then he was leaving. And I thought, nah, he can't be leaving, because we're absolutely flying. We're not too far off, you know, third place or second place, whatever it was. And he just came in, he parted ways. And then Zola came in. We're talking about a new contract. And then in the January transfer window, Bristol City came in to me to go on loan, but I was involved in the squad still. And Gianfranco just said, look, I've been told that I need to let you go. If not, I'm going to have to make it really uncomfortable for you if you stay here and make you train on your own. I didn't really want to go. I was negotiating a new contract. I wanted to stay at Birmingham for many more years. I actually see myself retiring at Birmingham and seeing out as many years as possible. But unfortunately, you know, it's probably taken out the powers of Gianfranco, because he's a really lovely guy and I couldn't imagine him wanting to make me train on my own. And unfortunately, the powers above probably would have instructed that. And that's where we were at. I think, you know, I left and Steve Cottrell, I worked with him at Bristol City, Portsmouth, sorry. And I had a really decent relationship with him, and he's a good guy. And he just said, look, I just don't think it's going to work from you. And since bumping into him after that, it was made clear that it was taken out of his hands. So that's just one of these things. It's unfortunate. I'd love to have stayed at Birmingham for many more years and done great things with that club, because, as I say, out of all the clubs that I've worked for, I think that was my favourite one. And I always, you know, I always check on their results to see how they're doing.
Fans don't often get to see this side of the game. All they see is the glory and the glamour and the adulation. We don't get to see this side of it, you know, what players have to go through sometimes.
Yeah, it's a load of crap, really. And as I say, I always want to stay at Birmingham. And when I was made to leave, and, you know, I remember when I was on my, I went on to my wedding, honeymoon, sorry, and got married really late on, because you normally, when international players go away, they're given a little bit more time off for when they come back. And so I told Gianfranco, I told Gary Rowett before I left. We changed managers in quick succession at that point. And the club were well aware that I was going on my honeymoon. But then when I returned back late from training, you know, Birmingham emailed me and saying, look, you're late for training. You're going to be fined a week's wage. And I was like, well, I'm going to have to go to the PFA, because you were well instructed that I was given the rights to go away, because I've just been on international duty. As soon as I come back, I was made to train on my own. And with Harry Redknapp, and I went into his office after a week, and I just thought, I can't be having this. And I just said, look, if I'm not in your plans, that's fair enough, but treat me like a human being. Because I think if you make mistakes, or you are looking to get people out in your workplace, for example, if you're in Tesco's, you don't get made to work in an aisle on your own and everyone can't come near you. It's just like, it's just crazy. So I was just making a point. Look, that's fair enough. You want me to train, but make sure you respect me to bring me in at normal hours, and don't make me come in at evenings or whatever you want to do to try and, you know, mentally break me. Because that's what happens at football clubs. You know, managers and clubs will try and mentally break the players. That's how it works. Mm-hmm. And that's unfortunate, because that just really takes everything that you've worked so hard for and dreamt about as a boy. You didn't really see that kind of side to it. And yeah, I went from training on my own to then be involved in the first team. Then I was playing championship games and so on. And then, and at that point as well, of course, squad numbers change. But I didn't get told, you know, my number 11 shirt was getting taken off me, to given obviously to Vassell at that point. I did have no one against any teammates of mine whatsoever. But it's just little things like that. I would have liked to have been told by the manager, look, we're changing your number because we've got another guy coming in. But I just thought, out of respect of kind of what I thought I did for the club previously to that, for the 2 or 3 years, which, you know, from the place when I first signed to where we ended up, we left in a great place. And I just thought I'd have, you know, that kind of respect, but unfortunately I didn't.
It's not something that you have to demand, mate. That's a human right to be treated with respect, to be fair. But sadly, and I've seen it in the game for years.
Yeah.
Manager don't fancy it. You train with the kids, they make you uncomfortable, and you ask, eventually you go. It's wrong, but as you say, it's in the game. But it's highlighted more, though, when you do have your own mental health issue. But let's talk about the football, because despite that, you're playing for Wales, you're playing with Gareth Bale, you're playing Euro games, whatever, you're playing for Birmingham, you played in the Premier League. Are there any games or goals that stick out for you?
Yeah, I think probably my first senior goal for Bristol City was obviously massive, because I was, you know, 16, 17 when I scored. Yeah. And my debut, obviously, I was the second youngest ever player for Bristol City. Then I become the youngest ever player for Wales, which I, for my debut, that was a memorable game, because I come on for Ryan Giggs, who was, you know, my hero growing up. And that, hence why, you know, I used to love wearing number 11. And I think probably my first goal in the Premier League as well. And Scott, and playing at Old Trafford, that was always a dream of mine, because I'm a United fan. And all the clubs, I've always tried to give my best. You know, of course, probably drinking sometimes probably got in the way, and my mental health issues got in the way, but no one really seen that. But I would always stay behind practice. I was always trying my hardest. I was in the gym trying to do what I needed to do to try and help my team as much as possible. I'm probably more vocal than most, which is probably why I didn't really last at many clubs, because I just didn't really like to put up with the bullshit, to be quite honest. I was always very straight talking. I'd always let people know that if I wasn't happy with certain things.
Isn't that the best way to be? And I think most players that I've known, a lot of players that I've known in the past particularly, that's the way it was. It was said, it was told you to your face, and then you got on with it. You forgot it. But these days, it seems like we're in a different era where you can't actually speak your mind. You've got to be a little bit false. You know, they call it an era of encouragement rather than tell the truth. Is that right? Have I got that wrong?
I think, well, you're definitely not wrong, because you know the game inside out as well. I think from that point of view, you have to be, I think that's, we're touching a point now where the younger generation, where I wouldn't say they're a little bit, you know, we have to be more aware of the mental health issues, which of course is very, very important. Mm. But we also have to be really careful. Are we on the lines of, we're going out to win first and foremost? That's the most important thing. Yeah. As a footballer, you're there to win a football match. And just because, you know, you're telling certain people what you demand of them, of the levels you set and the levels the football club set, you still should be able to tell people what you think that they've done wrong without taking it too personally. Because as you say, you know, when we were at Birmingham, we'd get ripped into for fun. You know, if a teammate came in and they thought I'd make a mistake, they'd rip into me. I wouldn't sit too much on that. I'd then go out to try and do as best I can, because I know they know that I should be at a certain level because they've seen it before. Whereas now, when I've come out to play football part-time, you can see the actual generation is changing a little bit, whereas before it was a little bit more cutthroat.
I suppose really your first cap for Wales must have been special.
Yeah, you know, of course.
Wearing that red shirt.
Coming on for, to be fair, looking back at my old Welsh photos now, we got the kit man actually must have got a little bit better, because he's we were allowed to pick our sizes first off when we signed. I think he only had extra large and I was drowning in it. But of course, yeah, that's all I dreamt about doing, is playing the Premier League, playing for Wales and trying to represent my country and playing with great players. And I think, you know, from such a young age, being in that squad to what we eventually achieved going to the Euros in 2016, I think I've never come across such a close group of players in my entire life. We were literally so close. And as I've said before, and I don't mind saying, it's the first time I've ever been on the bench for a football team and wanting my team to win. Whereas before I was thinking, right, I hope they have a beast and I can come on and influence the game. Yeah, exactly. So I think, but you know, that I think that's why we achieved so many great things, because we had the group of players who were not in the starting lineup, always, you know, we all wanted to do so well for each other.
Your first goal, was it against Luxembourg for Wales?
Yeah, Luxembourg.
It was a winning goal as well, a winning goal, wasn't it?
I think it might have been, yeah, or we, yeah, or actually, I think it might have been like, I think we actually beat him 5-1.
Maybe I've got it wrong then, but yeah. I thought it was, I knew you scored against Luxembourg. Sorry, it was 5-1, yes, you're right, I've just checked. Yeah. I just checked. 5-1, but you still scored, and that must have been a great feeling as well.
Do you know what? I came across the box and I was thinking it was squared to me, and I was thinking, just get connection on it, don't miss it. And looking back, it was just probably lucky it went in.
So, you know, you've been all points west, you know, you've had Wigan in the Premier League. Who was your manager at Wigan, by the way?
Paul Jewell's my manager there.
Paul Jewell, yeah. Have you had a favourite manager? I mean, you mentioned Gary Rowett quite fondly.
I'd probably say Gary Rowett, definitely. Probably the manager who's got me the most in terms of mentally got me as a human being. I think whereas others were kind of like, right, he's a party guy, he loves to go out. And I've had that throughout my entire career, really. Looking back, I didn't really make too much of it, but my agents would say to me, look, clubs like you, they want to put a bid in for you, but they think you're a party guy. And looking back, I just think, well, you know, that could have been resolved, because if they think I'm that kind of way, they could have got me some help, I don't know. To change it, exactly, right, as a human being. Because, you know, when a footballer's going out and they say, for example, the younger guy's coming through, we train the younger players to get certain habits out of their game to make them better players. Yeah. So we're physically looking after players to go in the gym, but not enough time is spent on them mentally. So, you know, maybe that's one thing that could have, hindsight's a wonderful thing, but hopefully we can start helping the younger players coming through a lot better. But Gary Rowett for sure is my favourite manager, just because he got me. And Chris Coleman as well, which, you know, I loved with the Welsh squad. He was brilliant. But I think tactically the best manager I've worked under would have to be Brendan Rodgers. His training was insane, and his philosophy of how he looks at the game was just brilliant.
Well, I mean, you've mentioned him there. He's doing a fantastic job as well now, isn't he? But just going back there, you mentioned two people. Chris Coleman, he would have understood what you were doing and going through, because he'd been there, hadn't he? I mean, he was quite the lad for the nights out when he was at Fulham and places with Horsfield and the rest of them. So he would have understood where you were going through. But would they have understood what you were going through between your ears, do you think?
No, I don't think so. Just because we, you know, when I was still in the Welsh squad, we still had a decent drinking culture. So after every game, you know, beers would get brought to the change rooms to crack on, or we'd go out on a night's out. And when we'd have away games, you know, fly away, we'd always finish with the session and going out. And Chris Coleman would normally sometimes grab the guitar and sing to us, which is, you know, they're great football memories you can't take away, you know, and that's, you know, it's amazing times. And I think, you know, unfortunately, he can't help people in those space of days. You know, it's not his job. And to be quite honest, I can only, it's not my fault, but I didn't speak about it anyway. So he can't look after everyone and guess at all, right? But if I'm showing the face that I'm happy, he's going to take obviously that as face value.
Yeah, absolutely. Probably I would think people with, you know, mental health issues, mental well-being issues, are probably the greatest actors in the world, because they put this facade on, don't they, of everything's all right with the world.
Yeah, of course. And when I played at Sheffield United, we had a car school of me, Gary Speed, James Beattie and Gary Naismith. And, you know, every time we'd meet up with Speedo, he was literally one of the best guys I've ever come across in my entire life. He was always helpful. He was always giving me tips at what I should do to be better. And he was always happy. I never come across him as, you know, as being miserable. The only time he was obviously extremely competitive, but then again, you don't get to that level of not being that, having that competitive edge and being a winner. So that just goes to show, you know, I was traveling with a guy and I didn't even know that he was going through these issues himself.
I suppose really, before we get onto it, who was your toughest opponent?
My toughest opponent one-on-one when I was playing as a winger, I'd probably say Ashley Cole, but the best player I've played against on the pitch would probably be Ronaldinho.
Oh, hang on, I'll just pick that name up.
I have to say something that's to be happy.
I've got to say, that is not a bad name. Just absolutely amazing. So, so playing against Ronaldinho was your toughest, but or the best player you played against. What was your career highlight? The highlight of that wonderful career that spanned so many years?
I think probably getting to play in the Premier League and saying that I've scored in the Premier League as well. But, you know, I love playing for Wales. I think there was no, you know, I always set out to play and I play with great players. You know, I've managed to play with my boyhood hero, which is Ryan Giggs, play with obviously Gareth Bale, which is, you know, Ramsey, great players. And, you know, I'm fortunate to say that a great achievement. I know it's obviously, you know, a lot of people say, well, it's only League One, but the way we got promoted with Doncaster as well on the final days, which is the emotions I'd never, ever forget when, you know, we were literally top of the league. If we, all we had to do was draw that, we get promoted. And if we win, we obviously go up as champions. And Brentford were in third position. And if they beat us, we would drop into third position. They'd get promoted and but so would Bournemouth. And they hit the crossbar, we broke down, and then we actually went on to score and literally to die in 30 seconds. So to do that, that was amazing as well.
Just what came first? Was it the alcoholism or the depression? Did the alcohol bring on the depression, or were you depressed and needed the alcohol? What was first?
Depression was the first one, because, you know, believe it or not, when I was a teenager, when I was a youngster, I never used to drink alcohol because I was always focused on becoming a professional footballer. So when my mates used to go down the park and, you know, smoke or they would go and drink, I was always getting prepared, ready for my games on the Saturday anyway. And my dad definitely wouldn't allow that to happen because very strict when it comes to obviously me to make sure that I followed my dream and stay dedicated, really. So depression came first, and then, you know, a lot of things happened from a young person going, you know, through a divorce and going through certain stuff to try and gain access to his children. And it just all spiraled out of control. I probably put on a bravado to say, you know, that everything's going great. And I just used to go out and party. And every time that I felt a certain way, I was going to drink more and so on. There was times now and again I could go out for a few, but more often than not, I just didn't know when to stop. And it would end up, instead of going out for the night, I'd be out for, you know, 24 hours, 48 hours.
Was that escapism? Was that because it blotted out everything for you?
Yeah, for a period of time, as I say, I was probably self-medicating to take away the pain and take away that hurting for a period of time. And then, you know, just eventually just got worse and worse and worse. And eventually the alcohol was not even taking me away from those dark places. It was put me in a worse position and a worse place where I was, as I say, trying to end my life, which was, you know, ultimately I didn't really want to do. At the time, I felt like that's all I wanted. I just want to be away from everyone. And that was it, really. I was so, from that point of view, I didn't really think about anyone else. I know it sounds quite harsh, and I got three kids, but I didn't really think about nothing else. I didn't think about the kids, just thought about me, just ending it, really, more than anything else.
I think from stuff I read, there was more than one time you felt like that you tried to end it. That has to be, for me, and I've not been there, but that has to be the lowest point in anybody's life, not wanting to be there, especially when they've got kids and stuff.
Yeah, it was. I was in that place for it felt like a long period of time as well, and it felt that I was at the bottom, but I didn't have the strength, or I didn't really want to get out of that position. And when you don't want things, you're not going to change anything. And that's where, you know, it was really strange, because I was away working in America, and I said to my friend, I had two or three drinks, and I said to him, how do you think I act when I'm drinking? He said, you're literally like a ticking time bomb ready to explode. And I said to him, as soon as I go home, I'm going to check into rehab. He said, oh, you won't check into rehab. As soon as I got home, I made sure I called Sport and Chance to get me into rehab as soon as possible. And fortunately for me, there was a couple of cancellations which they could bring forward my appointment. And so I checked into rehab. And that's where I go on about anyone with addiction. As soon as they want it, and they want it for themselves, and then they can make the change. If people around them want it, but that person doesn't, nothing's going to change.
How long have you been sober now?
So in February 15th, just gone, I was sober for 2 years. So
that's a great achievement, like, you know?
Yeah.
Because I, and I'm not making light of it, because I've never drunk in my life. I'm teetotal. I've never even tried it. So I don't understand that side of it. But I've got mates who do and drink a lot.
Yeah.
And I've got friends who I mention you're drinking too much. And they go, oh, I can give up any time I want. I've given up loads of times. And you realise then when they said they've given up loads of times that they can't give up.
Yeah. If they've given up loads of times and they're back on it, then there's a reason for it.
Absolutely. So without knowing and feeling it personally, I know from my friends what you're going through. But you've been sober 2 years now. On the mental health side, is that always on the cusp ready to hit you when you least expect it still?
Do you know what? When I feel a certain way, I don't really think about drinking. I think I've built up a resilience, and I have great people from like the AA program that I surround myself with, that if I feel a certain way, I can obviously contact them anytime. When I feel a little bit down, I feel that I've got such a routine and I feel I've got such a structure to my life that is a lot better than before. I just go and walk my dog, and or I just go for a walk, or I just go and listen to music, or I go to the gym, because obviously the gyms are back open. But before lockdown, I'd go to the gym and I'd have better structure and routine. So from that point of view, when I feel a certain way or I feel down, drink doesn't spring to mind, because I know where I've been before and I definitely don't want to go back to that place.
I remember doing that thing with you at Solihull Moors when we talked to a lot of academy youngsters and stuff. And do you have people to talk to when at that time? Because I know that was one of the big things that came out, is having somebody to talk to.
Yeah, I think, well, as I say, I've got my AA sponsor from the AA rooms, which is vitally important. And he's, you know, we speak to each other every single day without fail. And do you know what? He, even when he's going through terrible times, his end, you know, maybe family problems, whatever, he'll always message me on the button every single day, and it just goes to show that he's, wow, you know, he's very reliable and he's always there for me as well. So he's just a trusted friend. I think I have better people around me now than I ever have before, just because I've hit that rock bottom. Mm-hmm. And when you've hit that rock bottom, you then realize who's there for you and who's not. And I'm happy with that. I think, you know, I used to be in rooms full of thousands of people when I'm doing talks, or in stadiums full of thousands of people, and I'd feel alone. Whereas now, I'm happy to go out on a walk on my own, do things on my own, and I feel really present in that day. And some people might say to me, are you a loner because you're on your own? I actually feel more alive now being by myself rather than when I had loads and loads of people around me.
Was it the drink or the mental health issues? And I know they're combined, and I know they're a one. Was it that cost you your marriage?
Probably, yeah. I'd say a number of things. Yeah, that was, you know, the alcoholism and the mental health certainly didn't help, for sure. And yeah, I think that is, as well as being obviously me messing up on a few things and being involved in drinking and going out and thinking I was above everything else. Maybe the egotistic maniac was kicking in. And for sure, you know, the mental health, the drinking would have definitely played a part in that.
Now, this is a really difficult thing to mention to you, but how have your kids suffered because of it, or have you and the wife made sure they don't?
Yeah, so, you know, my youngest daughter, she wouldn't really see too much of it because she was never, you know, exposed to that. And my two children, they'd know that I would drink and stuff, but I would try and not expose it to them as much as possible. I think they've only seen one or two episodes. But I think I educate them more than anything else. I talk to them about certain things. I'm very mindful of my son's a teenager. I'm very mindful of when he's going out and he's trying to experiment certain things or whatever that might be. And to be fair to him, he's educated himself about alcoholism as well. And I think that, you know, they show a sign of protection to my side as well, because, yeah, you know, my dad's an alcoholic. He's reliant on alcohol, but he doesn't act how I used to act. Maybe, you know, my mum said in his younger days he could have been a certain way and so on. But when I would drink, I'd become very violent, or I'd become like a certain way, or I'd try and self-harm, which is not great, really. I just, you know, I thought I had blackouts and so on. So from that point of view, I try and educate my kids as much as possible about mental health and addiction.
Is the boy a football man?
Well, to be fair, we try and play touch out in the garden where we play, and if he loses, we have like a flick of the ear, so he gets his ear flicked. But we have a little kick about. He's never really had a huge interest in that, to be quite honest. He's and it got to a point, I took him to a game and he came in the car and I watched him and I said, "Oh, you're freezing, are you?" And he said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, you shouldn't be that cold if you're supposed to be running around. If you're not going to work hard, then there's no point being out there." And I truly believe if you're not going to work hard in anything, there's no point doing it.
Correct.
So he has interest in other things, and other things make him happy. So I just said, "Look, whatever you do, try and give it 100%. Try as hard, best as you can. And that'll be good enough for me. You know, just because you make it as a footballer, I'm not going to love you any less if you don't make it."
What I found staggering with what we've talked about is that none of your teammates saw it. None of your teammates saw it. Was that because you were good at covering it up, or was it because footballers are insular? I mean, I find it strange that nobody spotted the signs.
One teammate actually spotted it, but it took me to come out and speak about it. And then when I spoke about it, to be quite honest, when I did the interview for the BBC, I did it with a trusted Welsh journalist who used to come away with Wales. And he's a great guy. And he just said, "Look, are you ready to talk about things?" And I knew I was going to retire anyway. I didn't speak about mental health to gain another contract. I spoke about mental health because I knew I was going to retire, and I felt in that safe zone to do so. Because I wouldn't have spoken about it, to be quite honest, if I was playing. Just because, as I've said before, I truly believe clubs and managers would not offer you a contract if they thought you were mentally a certain way. And I still truly believe that that's the case today. So I spoke about it with him, and I wasn't expecting it to, you know, go all over, to be quite honest, all over the news, etc. So, well, I did speak about that. And then one of my teammates reached out and he said, "I knew you were quite similar to me." And I thought he was quite similar to me as well, because he was always out on a drink. So we would always do similar certain things. And we'd sometimes, more often than not, we'd clash on a night out because we were both lunatics. But I knew that he was a certain way and he knew that I was a certain way, but we never, ever discussed it, ever.
Football's not unique. There's no wall around them. Everything that we all suffer, footballers will suffer. You've proved that. Mental well-being is a big issue. So because of the football, the nature of football, are there footballers, do you think, like you, suffering, but suffering in silence?
Yeah, there'd be loads. There'd be a lot. There'd be thousands. You know, if you're talking along the numbers of 1 in 4, which I believe is I personally believe is less, but you have to think, if you've got a squad of 25, 30 players, there's a lot of numbers. And you have to think about the younger kids coming through, even the backroom staff, the guys who work above you in the commercial team, et cetera, et cetera. You have to think at a whole football club, there'd be a lot of people who are suffering who don't speak about it and don't have the support.
Well, God, would you want, I mean, you can't do this, but you are in a perfect position to sit down with the PFA, to sit down with the FA and the Premier League and say to them, this is what, you know, you've got to do something. There's a role there for somebody who's been there and done it. And you're the, you know, you've been there and done it. Do football do enough?
No, nowhere near enough. I think there's too many tick box exercises out there that betray, you know, you see the news, you see the TV adverts, you see the adverts on social media that we have these organizations that say they're helping with mental health. And I speak to people in the game every single day and they don't get the help. So it's just for show, really, because they're not really backing it up to do it. There's a lot of people who I know are footballers who are, you know, probably more educated, being at a higher level than me in certain, you know, parts of the game, who would love to take these roles on at the PFA and other organizations. But do we really want the change? You know, we have to even look at social media. you know, all this racism that football players are getting targeted from their performances. Again, the social media and these organisations really want to change it, because if they want to change these things, they can make it happen. Because I said the other day, you know, social media took Donald Trump off social media platforms. If you can take the US president off these platforms, you pretty much can take Joe Bloggs down the road. Yeah, you can take Joe Bloggs down the road off social media. So again, with mental health, with racism, with the online abuse, do we really want to change it?
That's a great point.
This moment in time, at this moment in time, we don't, because we're not changing it.
We've talked about footballers. For me, one of the things that stands out for me is academies and the younger players. We saw when we did that thing at Solihull, I mean, it's 1% will make it. So hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of youngsters whose pals think they're going to be Premier League stars and play for England, their parents think they're going to be professional footballers earning a fortune, all that pressure on them, and then they don't make it. That is inviting mental health issues. And is there enough done aftercare for youngsters in academies?
No, there's not. This is what I've always said. I think it's the focus is purely on the guys or these young kids coming through who are going to make it. We never look about who's the one who are not going to make it. So, and the thing is that they've gone from living their dream to be in a professional environment, to being along these guys that they've looked up to, their stars, if you like. And next, you know, they're in a normal working job. And the problem is people around them can't wait for that to happen, because they, in this country, we like that. We like people to fail. Correct. So, it's just a vicious cycle, really. We don't have the support of these young people who want to become professional footballers. We don't have the support. We don't have the aftercare. And from that point of view, yes, we can talk about mental health and the support that these professional players need in these academies. But also we need to make sure the care is for the ones who don't make it, because they're going to be going through a lot of these difficult times. Because I think the young Man City kid who was obviously a promising young star got released by Man City. He then ended up taking his own life. And, you know, you read about these things saying he had depression and so on, about the rejection of being released. And again, that just goes to show that we're not doing enough. But the problem is that we're always reactive rather than being proactive. We're all happy to post these on social media. Oh, we're so sorry for your loss. We're so sorry for this and that. But it can be helped by making sure that the things that we are posting get put into action. Because, as I say, these organisations are doing nowhere near enough. And it's going to get a lot worse, because we talk about COVID hitting and COVID hitting that, but the next pandemic will be mental health. And you see it more and more and more.
I couldn't agree more. As chairman of a mental health foundation, I see exactly where you're coming from. How big a part in people's mental well-being does social media play? Because I use it all the time. I have to, but I think it's the curse of the devil.
Yeah, it is the devil. I think, you know, even, you know, my 10-year-old daughter had to take off social media the other day because, you know, you're seeing people that are fake on social media, because you're seeing all these women who are looking a certain way, but then when you see them in real life, they're not what you see on social media. That's just a fact. And probably vice versa, what you see with my social media might look that I'm a certain way. And when you see me in real life, it's probably, you know, I'm not as tall as people make out. I'm not as, you know, this and that. So you're living to a certain expectation that is completely false. And you have young kids who are having that self-doubt, or they're body conscious, or they're this and that. And it's causing major, major issues, because we're not, you know, it's not real. Social media is not real. And no matter, I'm pretty sure you could be the same as well, but no matter what I post on a day-to-day basis, there's always going to be some idiot who will be, you know, a certain way, who just out to, you know, these keyboard warriors who just want to abuse you. And that's just the way it is, unfortunately. And, you know, even when I was playing football, if I had to have a bad game for Birmingham, or I'd have a bad game for anyone, I'd have inboxes for fun of just pure abuse. Get the fuck out of our club, and you leave, you're rubbish, you're this and that. And so it happens on a daily basis, you know. And I even had one disgusting message before, and I reported it on Instagram. I don't know if they did anything about it, where I only had two children at the time, and I lost a football match, and they said to me, "I hope your young daughter gets raped." And I just thought,
oh my.
So So you hear all this and that, and I don't really, that's the first time I've spoken about it on any podcast or anything, but you just get accustomed to it, and it's wrong, really, because all the things that all the footballers would have gone through over the years, and all the everyone really, celebrities, etc., it's just not okay.
It's not okay, and it affects a life. It's not okay, but not for footballers and celebrities. It's not okay to treat anybody like that. Let's get absolutely clear about that. Anybody. and I noticed that playing brings, listen, as a professional footballer, the rewards are great, but you know you're in the public eye. You know you're going to be criticised, and constructive criticism, I'm sure you'll take, but it goes over the top. And you've actually had to face death threats at one time at Cardiff, I think, when you played there. I think you scored there, didn't you? Which is not allowed.
I know, yeah. I was playing for Sheffield United, and I scored a penalty, and I was getting abuse all the game. And I just thought, I cannot wait to score and just give them something back. And I think my parents were in the crowd, and they were getting abused as well. When I after the game, they said, "Oh, we were getting all sorts of abuse in the crowd," and it was just really bizarre because yes, I was from Cardiff. I always wanted to play for Cardiff growing up as a kid. But unfortunately, the scouting system or anything didn't materialize. It's not my fault. And I always say to people is that, you know, if you get offered a job, say, for example, when I was playing for Swansea again, if you're a painter and decorator and you get offered a job and you're from Cardiff and you want to work in Swansea, you don't turn the job down if it pays you and it gets you near your family. It is what it is. You have to put food on the table. So
I think football fans forget that this, for them, it's a passion and a thing. But for you, it's your career. It's a job.
Yeah.
And end of story. But, you know, there are Cardiff fans who would think playing for Swans is a criminal offence. I mean, that's how it is, isn't it? It's black and white with them. Whereas you've got a family to support and you've got a mortgage to pay, et cetera, et cetera. They're most sensible people understand it. Where are you now as a person, do you think?
A lot happier person. I think, as I said to you before, I think I'm more in myself. I'm comfortable what I'm about. I have better boundaries. I'm not afraid to show, you know, what I think, talk about these issues, and it is what it is. Where it's taken me a long time to get to that stage. You know, when I first spoke about mental health, I was so nervous. I was very anxious when that came out. I was really rock bottom when I went to rehab, and I just kind of think, well, I've been to rehab, so I've been at my worst. Where else can it go? You know, and it is what it is. And I don't really care about what people think of me, as long as my children and my family are healthy. That's all I really care about. I'm happy. I play football part time for Barry Town, and you know, that's great. I can hopefully pass on my knowledge. You know, I didn't really necessarily miss the game. I didn't miss playing football. I missed the competitive edge. I missed going out and winning, and I missed having that team banter, and I miss helping a team win football matches, basically. And you know, I get to play football with my cousin, he plays there, and the few guys that I know around from the Cardiff area. So it fits in really well what I'm doing. He gets me out exercising, gets me away from the kids for a few hours as well. So it's all right.
I was going to ask you why you're not in the game. I mean, you've part answered it there, but why, you, with your experience, why are you not still in the game? Is being a coach and a manager, is that not for you, do you think?
Do you know what? I actually didn't think about being involved in the game at all, just purely because what we touched on earlier, I think there's so much politics and bullshit that is involved in football. I really hate that part. When I first retired, I got offered an agency job, and just the way that went around about things, I didn't last very long because I didn't really agree with the approaches, how footballers, I would love to be kind of like a mentor to maybe... Yeah. Footballers coming through, if they needed to speak to me, or if I was a coach, then I'd maybe do that. I've only just started to recently think about these sort of things. For the first 3 years, I couldn't think of anything worse. But you know, when you see a few coaches or managers, and you hear some of the shouts, especially at the level that I'm playing at now, I just think I could offer so much more.
Mm.
And pass on my experience, especially to the youngest players coming through. Maybe that could be something that I could work on or look towards, you know, maybe in the future. But I'm still enjoying playing. Of course, if my manager needs me for any of that side of things, he'll always touch on my experience at certain stuff, and he'll, you know, bounce ideas off me. And hopefully that'll continue. Maybe when I finish playing, I might be able to, you know, be a little bit more helpful.
I started the Former Players Association at Birmingham with Kevin Broadus a long, long time ago. But we started the charity football team in 92, which I managed. And you know, we've raised 1.6 million for local charities since then. But the one thing every player, and they change. I mean, we've got players now like Darren Carter, Gary McSheffrey, late Marcus Painter was at Swansea, younger legs. But they all say the same thing. The one thing they miss is the dressing room and the banter and that stuff. Is that how you were?
Yeah, I love the banter. I was always, you know, heavily involved in that, whether that would be with club football or you know, the international. When we were away with Wales, I would always be the one who was organising the parties to make sure that we had, you know, the best times, etc. So I was always involved, and I do miss that. And when I meet up with a couple of my football friends that we've retired, and we meet up, you have that connection, you have that banter, and it's so different than like normal life banter. It's just really weird to say, but it completely is. I remember when I used to go out with other mates, and you know, I'd have a couple of footballers out with me, and we'd see other, you know, my mates, and it was just so much more ruthless. Yeah. The ruthless dressing room is just so different, and we got it, and that's what you miss the most. You're in that team environment. You're obviously going out there to win and be competitive together, and you have that banter after it.
Every club has a social secretary, doesn't it?
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Just finally, let's talk about the David Cotterill Mental Health Foundation. How well has that done, and where are you going with it, and what do you want to achieve?
So what we've, it's been really difficult in lockdown, to be quite honest. We've offered as much support as we can, but the main reason, and one of the things that we're doing really well, is that we had Mental Health Anonymous meetings, which were in coffee shops. So people would go there, share their experience, and we were getting to such a good point that one of the people were attending these meeting places, that they, when they felt alone, they were actually going to that coffee place and having a coffee because that was their safe environment. So we provided that kind of real safe place for them to go to. And we were, you know, we had personal trainers that were creating a healthy body, healthy mind. So they had the Mental Health Anonymous meetings, then they had the PT sessions to train, and COVID really hit the people in the foundation really hard, because, you know, we had one guy who, when COVID hit, he lost all the structure, lost all the routine. He missed the meetings rooms that much. He put on like 3 or 4 stone. And so it did really affect people that much. And so what we're trying to achieve now, we obviously got the PT sessions that are going on. We've brought in a lot more things to help with schools, to exercise, cookery programs, to budget for help the families, because of course in the local area where I'm from, the council state I'm originally from, there's not much money in any schools, etc. So we're trying to help as much as possible that they can budget food for their families to provide the best care, and to try and educate as well. We're going to try and keep that moving and try and help as many people as possible in local communities to get out exercising, and that's what we'll put on with the foundation.
If people are listening and think they'd like to help, how can they contact to help the foundation? Is there a contact email address or website or whatever?
Yeah, so it's at the davidcotterillfoundation.com, and you know, email us at any time. And we're on Instagram, we're on Twitter, and you know you can message us, and we've got a team that will respond as soon as possible. And if we can't, we always try and point people in the right direction, because we're not at that level yet where we got, you know, a text messaging service, which I would love to have. With the Crystal Matrix, as I mentioned before, we, you know, we are working on our own retreats, our own, you know, things at boot camps, etc., to make sure that we can provide and try and help people mentally as you know, mental well-being, really.
You do seem very positive. Do you have regrets, or is there no time for regrets in your life?
No regrets. I think I've seen something actually what Anthony Hopkins said the other day, and he's a recovering alcoholic, and I think he's like 30-35 years, and he said something the other day which really hit home. He's like, right, you can't really dwell on your past and your regrets, because you don't live there anymore. You need to keep moving. You made a mistake, but we all make mistakes as human beings. It's how you then your next move is the most important thing. Yes, I've made mistakes in my past. Yes, I didn't really want to hurt any people in my past life, but that's not the David of old, and I just try and keep moving forward and try and be better every single day. And that's the thing. Even though I do have my own mental health foundation, it doesn't mean that I'm perfect and doesn't mean that I'm the best person on the planet. I still make mistakes as well.
David, it's been a real pleasure. And I mean that seriously, a real pleasure talking to you. And the honesty has smacked me right in the face in a sport that at times is morally bankrupt, I might add. But you've hit me straight in the face with the honesty with how you speak. Thanks very much for doing it. It's been an absolute pleasure, my friend. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you as always.
No worries, pal. But folks, leave a review. If you like what you've heard or you don't like it, please, please, please leave us a review because that's what matters. And thanks for listening. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.